It's like, I don't believe there's any truth anywhere. Capital T.
Wow. This might be about to get messy then.
What the fuck does that mean?
I want to see a demonstration. Seriously.
And I mean that in the nicest way possible. I'm just legitimately confused.
You sound like a relativist, Wes.
How many quarts of liquor did you have today? A human being cannot walk through a wall, especially like a cinder block wall.
Yes, they can. We just established.
And maybe if they're fired through a cannon, but that's not really walking.
No, right? I thought you agreed with me. So can I make a suggestion?
This is all stolen concept fallacy stuff, right to the core. There are facts that we rely on every single day, like Brett said about the nihilist.
I didn't agree with that.
All right, deep breath.
In my mind, right, I can travel to Alpha Centauri.
I think I'm being more libertarian than you guys.
I would let a complete fucking idiot come on the show and say whatever they wanted because I respect the intelligence of the audience.
Don't do that. Don't do that.
I think that would be fun. I'm going to put an ad on Craigslist.
I wouldn't set fire to people I want to be friends with.
If I'm in a property dispute with Wes or something because I decided to light his house on fire while masturbating because I thought it was cool.
I think you did the thing that I had a problem with again, too. Saying this...
It's understanding reality, the thing that exists that you're living and breathing in. No, it isn't. How could it be begging the question?
You changed the definition.
You changed the definition from sex.
I did.
From rape to sex.
God, I hate ad hominem arguments so much.
Porn will take down ISIS.
I'm completely playing inside their game with their rules. I'm just winning.
That's a different question.
Come on, let's not get fucking silly here.
Wait, that's a different question.
Hold up,
it's not silly. I love you.
I love you too.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is September 24th, and this is part one of two of the conclusion of the Renegade History course with Thaddeus Russell, for now anyway. And I have a few items that I want to go through before we get into today's conversation. Item number one, appreciation and gratitude. First of all, Thaddeus, for volunteering so much of his time and his energy to help produce what I think are some very interesting and at times challenging conversations about history, politics, philosophy, and culture. I also want to thank Carlos Morales and Wes Bertrand for their participation, at times for their patience, at times for their persistence. And of course, last but not least, I want to thank everybody who submitted written or audio questions for this conversation. And that moves me from item number one, which is appreciation, to item number two, which is a bit of regret. As the moderator, I think I could have done a better job of moving us a little more swiftly through this first question, dealing with objectivism and relativism and the question of whether or not there is such a thing as truth. Initially, I thought about setting a 15 to 20 minute time limit per topic, but I also feel like this is something that listeners, at least from the feedback that I saw, listeners really wanted us to press Thaddeus on this issue. So we did, and maybe we wound up belaboring it a little bit too long. The reviews of the YouTube video of what you're going to hear today, a little bit mixed. One listener, here's a comment that comes to mind, described the conversation as maddening, folks. So yeah, I'm partially regretful that I didn't move through more of the questions and incorporate more of people's thoughts and concerns into this conversation. I would like to, perhaps at the beginning of part two in the Q&A, read everyone's questions just so they can get some acknowledgement. Some of them were very thoughtful. And I know I already mentioned this, but there's full coverage of both parts of the Q&A that will be podcast 310A and 310B. It's all on YouTube. And I'll wrap up just by saying this. If you haven't visited our YouTube channel in a while, or if you've never been there, holy shit, are you in for a treat if you ask me? School Sucks Podcast is our username. I have recently, over the course of the last few weeks, resumed the Best of John Taylor Gatto series, covering some of the sections of the underground history of American education. We're currently working through chapter 7, which is called The Prussian Connection. This is something that I've always wanted to explore in more depth. But I really encourage you to check those videos out, share those videos. I'm really trying to, through that video series, expose a new audience to the research of John Taylor Gatto on the history of the school system and its agenda. And I'm trying to take his research, his writing, and transfer it into an easily consumable and perhaps for some people more entertaining presentation and more accessible versus the book. All you have to do is go to YouTube and press a button and it's happening. I mean, people are already on YouTube all day to watch their favorite cat videos. Gato, by the way, Spanish for cat. So there's really no reason why this shouldn't all work out. All right? So anyway, that's it. Thanks so much to everyone for listening. Take care.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks. I'm Brett. I'm in the live studio tonight in Manchester with Carlos. Hey, Carlos.
Howdy there.
And Wes Bertrand. Hey, Wes.
Hey there.
And we join forces tonight to take on Thaddeus Russell
dun, dun, dun.
Out in California. Welcome back, Thad. Thanks for joining us again.
Well, now I'm not so sure I'm glad to be here, but okay. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
All right. So I promoted this show over the course of the last week. We put out a couple requests for submissions of questions. We received more than we're going to be able to deal with. I wouldn't be shocked if we didn't get past the first two, right? Carlos, you're kind of chomping at the bit.
I don't know what you're talking about whatsoever, but what are the questions, though, that that they wanted to throw out before I just start bringing up things that are written down on a piece of paper?
I just wanted to get a sense of how you're feeling.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm feeling pretty good right now. You know, I'm pretty cozy. This is a nice chair. But essentially, what I wanted to talk about today were some of the points that, you know, in the wonderful conversations and podcasts that you've been having with Thad for, what is it, a couple of months now?
Yes.
It's been like...
That's like a year, right?
It's been a year of conversations. Yeah. Within a lot of the conversations, the nature of truth, the nature of ethics, and scientific progress, and those kind of discussions, they've been kind of brought up in some of the conversations, but they've never really been hit on. And that's why I think this could be a really good conversation so that I can gain more of a perspective from a viewpoint that I've not really taken the time, I think, to learn about. And I think it could be a good win-win as far as, you know, the communication knowledge is concerned.
Absolutely. We asked Wes to join us too, Thad, because he's very well-versed in objectivism, better than anyone I've ever met. And that's come up in some of our past conversations. This also has an extremely pleasant way of explaining objectivism to people, which is almost a non-existent quality.
Yeah, it didn't used to be that way, actually. Before my compassionate communication days in Los Angeles objectivist meetup groups, it'd be like me against all these big O objectivists, right? The orthodoxy.
Yeah.
Because I was the anarchist in the crowd, and that's unheard of in the orthodoxy of objectivism.
Ayn Rand didn't say she was okay with it, therefore it's bad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It'd be chaos.
Yeah,
you'll have street gangs.
It's gonna be just like the movie The Warriors. Just people with leather vests throwing around Molotov cocktails. Awful.
It's my favorite movie.
But there is a sort of moral righteousness that objectivists like to wield, and Rand has definitely indulged in that. You know, in her writings.
All right, we're going to let listener questions drive the conversation. We're going to start with an audio submission from a listener named Harold in Maryland.
Thad, I have enjoyed your podcast with Brett. In one episode, I believe you said, and I quote, "I do not believe in truth, with a capital T," unquote. Yet, your book, A Renegade History of the United States, seems to be full of truths which have been mysteriously omitted from public education. Would you care to comment? Do you agree with the correspondence theory, which says that an idea is true if it corresponds with reality?
Should I just go ahead?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, actually, you know what? Just for the record here, I have a minute from that show. So this was our conversation back in June, and this is what you said. Now, I've come at this whole thing through the lens of objectivism. That's where I came from. Mm. And
again, I know as much about I know less about objectivism than I do about Stefan Molyneux, but from what I've seen and heard, I don't think I like it.
All right. And
you wouldn't.
First of all, I don't believe in objectivity, right? So that's a problem.
Yeah, there you go.
That's what I wanted to talk about. Just so we know the angles that we're coming at this from. You consider yourself a postmodernist, which I know very little about, and I would like, and probably a lot of my audience doesn't know that much about it either. So can you just tell us what that is?
Well, it means, you know, different things for different people. It's a very loose term. I mean, for me, The piece of what's called postmodernism that I'm really wedded to and that's really important for me is essentially relativism, sort of a rejection of truth claims.
Mm-hmm.
Across the board, you know. So I am a radical relativist. Like, I don't believe there's any truth anywhere. Capital T.
Wow, this might be about to get messy then.
Okay. So your thoughts on Harold's question?
Yeah, so I am a professional historian, which means that I have to operate within the structures established by this thing called the historical establishment or the historical profession. And they set out these rules, right, which they invented out of their minds. It didn't come from nature, didn't come from God. They said that certain things are evidence, and certain evidence wins arguments, and good arguments get you jobs.
Yeah.
Or make you a prominent historian or change minds, etc. So I simply operate within that set of social constructions. And so I play by their rules, but all the while knowing that these aren't written in stone or in nature. They're just the inventions of people who call themselves historians. So I look for the things that will persuade them, which is particular kinds of evidence. And so that's what my book is full of. It is full of evidence, I think. I think it's full of evidence that, and I think Harold agrees with me on this, that it's full of evidence that that should be at least persuasive to professional historians and others who judge the world according to that set of criteria. So what I'm, you know, many, many, many academics agree with me on this. You know, we don't claim to be speaking or writing the truth, even when we present evidence like Americans consumed 2 quarts of liquor per day in the colonial era. That's a kind of piece of evidence that's in my book, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can call that a fact. And a lot of people like to do that. They like to sort of draw a line between what are called facts and interpretations of the facts, or facts and arguments. And I don't even do that. So to me, that particular fact can actually be read, interpreted in any way. And I think they're all legitimate. I think you can read that in any way. I happen to read it in my book in a particular way to support a particular argument, but I don't claim that to be the only true or real or accurate way to do it. So what I'm saying here is actually fairly commonplace in academia. I wouldn't say it's a majority position, but I think it's a powerful minority position among academics in the last 30 to 40 years since the rise of what's called postmodernism. We will talk about that more broadly and what that means. But that's what I say to people who come back at me with, well, you wrote this book that's full of evidence. Do you not think that evidence is true? And all I have to say is, well, I think it's true within the sort of map or pattern that historians and others have placed on the world, right? So sort of it operates within that logic system, but that logic system is an invention, which doesn't mean it's bad, which doesn't mean it's not real. It just means that it comes from human minds. It's not written by nature or by God.
Okay, I'd like you to just add a definition that came from that audio clip that I played, truth with a capital T. Right. Mm-hmm. So are you talking about pieces of a picture when you're presenting this evidence, but not something that's like a finality that there's no questioning this anymore? What is truth with a capital T?
Yeah. When I say that, I usually mean what we call essentialism, sort of essentialist claims. So there's two, generally speaking, there have been sort of two kinds of essentialist claims. One is that things are determined, the truth of things or truth comes from God. Course, so that's the oldest and best known one, right? And the second one, which was put in place first by Plato and some of the early Greek philosophers, but really, of course, became nearly dominant in the West, during the Enlightenment, or by Enlightenment philosophers who replaced God with religion. So they said, God with nature.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, instead of looking for God's word to find truth, you look in nature, you observe nature, use the scientific method. And through that, you will find truth in nature. But the assumption there is, of course, that there is a truth that exists outside of human consciousness, that is not a creation of human beings, that it's independent of our minds, that mm-hmm. there is something outside of human beings. So if we all cease to exist tomorrow, there would be a truth in the world, or many truths, right? Including, and this is where I find it very, very difficult to, to respect, is when people actually claim that there's a moral truth outside of human consciousness. So that if we all cease to exist tomorrow, murder will be wrong the next day. In answer to your question about what I meant by capital T truth, that's what I mean. It's when it's sort of truth claims that are essentialist, meaning that there's an essence in them that is outside of human beings or outside of human consciousness.
Okay.
So from the objectivist point of view, the orthodoxy, just the metaphysics, and there's not much dispute about this, they would say that existence or entities exist outside of human consciousness. So reality is objective in the sense that it is distinct from human consciousness. Consciousness is an aspect of reality, it would contend. So I get what you're saying about the historical context, because I'm wondering, this committee or commission that came up with this notion of the evidence, what that means, what's their definition of evidence in the historical context? Is it
right.
it's basically not definitive, right? It's still open to conjecture
right.
because there's lots of interpretations involved. There's not
right.
like hard facts about it.
Right. And so another word for what I believe is historicism, meaning that things are historically contingent. So, for instance, what constitutes evidence, right? The rules about that have changed over time, right? Historically, if you look at how historians judged evidence 100 years ago, is quite different than the way we judge it now. So, for instance, I mean, even very, very recently. So, I mean, I'm actually of the generation of historians who use evidence from popular culture, right? So and this is very new. We watch movies, we watch TV shows, we read comic books, we look at clothes that people wear, we listen to music, and we present that as a text, as textual evidence, right? That was not taken seriously at all. Just even 20 or 30 years ago, it's still to this day, among many professional historians and social scientists, that's not taken seriously as real. It's not considered to be real evidence.
Why was that, by the way?
Well, there's a lot of interesting answers to that question, but you get my point, though, right? That it's sort of, and then 50 years ago, evidence of what people who weren't presidents and generals and inventors and senators of their lives, that wasn't really considered to be real evidence either. It didn't really tell you anything true about a society. The way to ascertain the truth was to look at the elites. You know, that was generally accepted. But this idea, so in other words, the idea about evidence itself, even in this particular example, has changed historically over time for various historical reasons. So truth is historically contingent is the claim that I'm making.
And I can kind of understand that, but I think more what we're going to is the question of logic and those kind of notions.
Sure.
Whenever me and you are having a conversation, I bring up this thing about axioms, right, which are self-evident truths as a result of just having a conversation, right? So I cannot make a claim which is contradicted by the very actions that I'm committing. So if I state the words, for instance, language is meaningless, in your mind, a specific thought comes into your mind, correct, of what I just stated. So therefore, language is not meaningless because I'm using language in order to back up that particular claim. Right?
Okay.
I think he kind of can agree with that concept, correct?
I'm not sure, but keep going.
Okay. So the thing is whenever we state there is no truth, that in and of itself is a truth claim.
A truth claim, yeah, right.
Yeah, and do you see where we could possibly be a little bit not understanding your statements here?
Yeah, so I've gotten that from every student in every class for 20 years.
That doesn't dismiss the question. That doesn't dismiss the notion, though. That's, I mean, priests also say, well, every single person's ever said, oh, well, they're, there is no God. Oh, well, I've heard that repeatedly.
No, so is agnosticism a truth claim?
Agnosticism is a statement of belief, right?
No.
Actually, excuse me. No, agnosticism is a statement of knowledge. Atheism is a statement of belief.
No.
Is that Gillette's?
No.
No, that's not. Gnostic means knowledge. A means none, right? So you do not have knowledge whether or not it's true.
Right. Atheism. It's a claim, it's a claim of lack of knowledge.
Yes, you're correct.
So right. That's what I'm doing here with truth claims. I'm claiming a lack of knowledge and that there can be no knowledge or that there is no knowledge.
Because it's open to sort of a biased interpretation of the evidence, right? Because it seems to me that the sampling is what's really the issue. Like, are we sampling from this group of people as indicative of the historical trends or what actually happened? Or are we sampling, you know, like you said, that a few years ago they didn't admit some of this other evidence that people in, you know, in media and popular culture would typically look at as evidence today, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's one problem with it. Yeah. So, I mean, here's the way I think about it. I think this will help. I hope it'll help. So, I believe the relativist claim generally, and this is where I am, is that what we get are sensory perceptions, right? These things, these points of light or, you know, or touch or sound come in through our eyes and our skin and our nose and our ears, right?
Right.
Now, to the infant, that's just random, meaningless dots, points of light, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So what we do is we draw lines, essentially we draw lines around these points of light and label that one, that shape, a tree, and then we label this action by a person against another person, murder, right? But those things, those categories, those lines, those shapes don't exist until we do that, until we place the right. And an infant looking at a man cutting off the head of another man would have no idea what that is and certainly wouldn't make a moral claim about it, would have no idea that that's bad or good or otherwise, right? So that's, in other words, that really, I think that's the best way of explaining this relativist claim, is that all these things, whether it's a claim about the physical world or it's a claim about morality, are simply inventions or categories that come from our minds that we impose upon the world. Now, that doesn't mean that any of it is bad or wrong or we shouldn't live according to these patterns and rules that we establish. I'm not saying that. It's just that I see no reason whatsoever, except bad reasons, to believe that they come from outside of us.
You know, before we move on to something else, something that I was thinking might be helpful is to very, very quickly walk, you know, we're all coming from the objectivist point of view here, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe walking it through the first four branches of philosophy and then asking you, Thad, to do the same for relativism or postmodernism. And I can do that very simply. And this is good.
I do. I mean, that's great, and I'm all for that. We should get to the politics of it, though, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
and I do want to, you know, one of the things I want to argue is that libertarians should absolutely be relativists. Absolutely.
All right.
It makes no sense
absolutely
to me at all.
Absolutely be relativists.
Objectivism has no business with libertarianism.
I'm going to go ahead and make an absolute statement based off of the evidence provided to me regarding what other people should do. Do you understand why that might be a little bit confusing?
Carlos, you're not hearing it, so you didn't. I didn't.
Your point.
No. So I'm operating again. Right,
what if we just relatively be absolutist?
Right?
Let him go. Go ahead, Tad.
I'm operating within the logical pattern established. I'm not making a claim that it's true. I'm saying within the logic of libertarianism, which is a social construction, objectivism doesn't fit logically. It doesn't fit within its own logical structure.
Okay. Well, when it gets to the fourth branch of philosophy, a lot of us agree that to some degree it fails as far as the tenets of objectivism laid out by people like Ayn Rand and Leonard Peikoff. Yeah, it didn't go all the way. So I think that if you've identified that there's some kind of seeming contradiction with the basics of objectivism and the principles of libertarianism, yeah, they don't line up perfectly. And
let me let me qualify this.
Yeah.
And I said this before, but let me say it again really clearly. I have literally not read a single word of Ayn Rand or any objectivist. So all I'm responding to here is objectivism in its sort of generic philosophical form.
You know, you can see the movie now. It's part three is out, Atlas Shrugged. And I'm sure there's going to be plenty of room in the theaters to see it.
Oh, yeah. Tons of room in the movie theater.
It lasted one week in the theater in Boston.
Really?
Yeah. There's one about 20 miles from there that's still showing.
I thought it was going to go straight to VHS tape.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
I mean, the first one should have.
These are pretty horrible.
It's fucking terrible. Anyway.
It's co-produced by Reason, isn't it?
I don't know.
But God knows Koch Brothers behind it.
They definitely produced the first one.
My friend Duncan Scott actually resigned from the process. He was helping with the script, and he actually worked with Ayn Rand to restore We the Living, that movie that was banned by Mussolini.
Yeah.
Because he kind of connected the dots, and he said, hey, this isn't just about communism. This is about fascism, too. We got to get rid of this film. So he helped Rand restore it, and he was working on the script for this one, and I guess they just went off the rails, and he's like, I can't be part of this project. So
funny tangent, really quick, if I can just do a quick little tangent. And this actually ties into our last conversation, Thad. This will be interesting. So I'm in Manhattan. This was like 6 or 7 years ago, and it was right when I was getting into objectivism. So I'm downtown, and I'm looking at the big Atlas statue across from the whatever that is, St. Peter's. And I'm taking pictures of it, and I'm just in awe of it. And this man walks up to me, and he goes, look at the statue's face. He said, who is that? Whose face is that? I said, I don't know. Atlas? And he's like, it's fucking Mussolini. He's like, it's Mussolini's face on the statue. And apparently the sculptor who did that was like a big Mussolini fan. It was an American, and I was like, there's no Mussolini fans in America when that was made, but now I know better. And if you look at that statue's face, it is very much Benito Mussolini, who we talked about in the last show. All right, so back on track. Just to quickly go through, and you guys can fill this in if you think I leave anything out, but I'm just trying to run through this as fast as possible. So for the first four branches of philosophy, for objectivism, metaphysics is what exists question is that reality is objective. We observe it through the five senses plus any kind of invented instrumentation, that there is nothing supernatural. The epistemology, how do we know?
Can I add to the metaphysics?
Yeah, okay. Sure.
The three axioms, the law of identity, right. The law of causality, and the law of non-contradiction.
Yep.
So that's basically coming from
Aristotle. Metaphysics begins with the question of whether there is metaphysics.
Yeah, right? the nature of reality. What is this thing I'm in that I have to figure out, essentially? Yeah.
Yeah.
So things are what they are. They don't act in contradiction to what they are. And they do causal things based on their properties, their identity.
Right. The epistemology, the how do we know, is that reason is used to make sense of that objective reality.
Can I add one more?
Yes, please do. I'm glad you're here.
So logic is the key for epistemology from an objectivist standpoint, because it is the, Rand called the art, but it's also the process of non-contradictory identification. So we're looking at things in reality, existence, and or units. And we're looking at them from the vantage point of the fact that there's no contradictions here. Things are what they are and can't act in contradiction to those things.
Right. Absolutely. No contradictions in nature.
Yeah.
And exactly. Thaddeus is shaking his head like really, really intensely. So let's not just skip it over.
So if you're disagreeing about the same thing in the same respect, so, you know, one person is correct, one person is incorrect, right? Because a square can't be a circle. Right. So it all hinges on the definition. You might have a different definition than Brett on a certain subject. Right?
Which is exactly why we're doing this right now, because I felt like before when we were in our previous conversations, we were going so fast. Obviously, we're not all face to face, so this isn't the best medium of communication. Things can get pretty jumbled.
Yeah.
So I thought the more we could lay out as far as definition is concerned, the better
we'd be. We're all good. We're good. Yeah. Keep going.
All right. The ethics. Here's a trivia question, Thad. What has been the biggest criticism from people on the left of Ayn Rand and the objectivists when it comes to their ethics?
I don't even care, but we'll go.
All right.
We can do that. We can do that if you want.
Selfishness.
Yeah. Selfish, greedy bastards.
Yeah,
exactly.
I don't know. It's all stupid and ignorant. I mean, I'm not a... I obviously don't like Ayn Rand. I mean, from what I know about her, but it's... I care even less about the criticisms of her. So keep going.
Okay, but no, the reason why I bring it up is because it lines up with exactly what you've been telling us for weeks or months, which is it should be about rational self-interest. And that was pretty much the foundation.
So the criticisms of her, I think, are, from my perspective, worse than Rand's own philosophy. But anyway, keep going.
Oh, okay.
Oh, right. 150 fucking percent agreement. And he's the majority of the time,
they're
liberals yell about Ayn Rand. They're people who have either never read it, or they're arguing about the points I completely agree with. They're like,
well,
you know,
so as two of you guys know, you know, my thing is self-interest, right? The politics of self-interest.
Yes.
So to the extent that their critique or criticism of Rand is that she celebrates selfishness, and I don't, who cares whether she does or not? I'm just saying the criticism is that, right? Then that places those people on the opposite end of the spectrum from me. So it's the critics of her, I find more problematic than Rand herself, from my politics.
And to those critics, if you pose the question, can you celebrate something selflessly? What do you think they would say?
I don't know. We can definitely talk about the left.
Okay,
that's my obsession. But
all right, and then we can leave it at politics, which they talked about free market capitalism and obviously individual rights, but somehow government.
Well, a laissez-faire capitalist scenario. So there's like three branches of libertarianism here that we're dealing with, and only one of them is consistent with objectivism as it's understood logically, not as the orthodoxy sees it. Orthodoxy, Rand saw it as laissez-faire capitalism, which means a monopolistic, a legalized monopoly that's adjudicating individual rights, you know, and funded voluntarily, of all things. Now, there's also the classical liberal view, which is the founding fathers, you know, so-called, that designed a constitution with, you know, taxation and regulation built into the framework. So that's a violation of the non-aggression principle, obviously. And then there's the anarcho-capitalist version or the agorist version or voluntarism. It depends on how you look at your use of the political means to achieve freedom. You know, people that are voluntarists are on that end of the continuum that says there's no justification to use the political means because it is violent. It is aggression. At the end of the day, there's a gun pointed in somebody's face telling them what to do. So
those are the first four branches of philosophy for objectivism. And if we were going to talk about postmodernism, how would you describe the metaphysics or the what exists of postmodernism? Is that even a fair question?
Well, everything's a fair question. I don't know if it's a. I'm not sure how to answer it. Can you ask it differently? Maybe
I'll throw it to one of these guys to ask that question differently.
I mean, I'm not. I want to. The way to answer it is to find out what you want to know. So I'm not. So you know what I mean? Because I'm not sure how to answer that otherwise.
Carlos, can I take a shot?
What are you guys getting at? I'll try.
Okay. Well, the question is just more a matter of can we know anything? I mean,
that's the
epistemology. So the metaphysics question. Sorry.
But anything is a concept for metaphysics, right?
Yeah.
Anything. Are there things out there? And I was going to ask you, what about facts?
Yeah. Okay. So I think this is, the metaphysics and epistemology are closely linked. So, I mean, for me, I guess, when I hear truth claims, it sounds like metaphysics, right? So the original truth claim, of course, is God, right? That there's a God and he has established this and that, and he's established not only the physical world, but he's established the truth about the world, right?
A concept to which, so, you know, there's no referent in reality, you know, that refers to God. So they're pulling that concept out of thin air, essentially.
Right. And so it's also, here's the thing about it. It's a conversation stopper. Right. <Yeah. laughs> So once you make a truth claim like that, that's essentialist, right? That's rooted in God or nature. There's nothing left to be said about it.
But radical skepticism also leads to meaningless conversations as well, though, right? Because
just stay with my point there, right? Does that make sense to you, right? If you and I agree that God established the truth about something, then there's no reason to study it. There's no reason to discuss it. There's no reason to question it, certainly, right?
Other than who established it?
God.
Who's that?
and
that's where they're stumped,
so,
you know.
I'm getting at truth claims, right? So if you make a truth claim that's essentialist, that is rooted in God, theology, or nature, right? Then the conversation's over.
Yeah, it's
you guys get that, right?
But wait a second, the nature one I take issue with because that's the methodology of science. We're looking at nature and we're trying to figure out causal relationships, right?
No, but once you establish a truth, once you make a claim that there is a truth in nature that you found, right? X, whatever that is.
Yep.
murder's bad, whatever. Property rights should be defended by the state, whatever it is, right?
Once you agree
that is comes from nature, then it's over. Then we're done with that conversation.
So nature, it's all within the confines of nature. That would be the metaphysics of just identity. As Rand said, you know, existence is identity, consciousness is identification. So the job of consciousness is to identify the things in reality. For instance, would you agree that it's a fact that we're talking over the internet right now? Indisputable fact.
No, it's not indisputable. So we can interpret what's happening right now in infinite ways.
How many quarts of liquor did you have today? Or me?
Again, yeah, right. that can all be and has been interpreted in all sorts of ways. But just, I want this, I'm making my first criticism of objectivism here. I want you guys to stay with it. Just you don't have to agree with it, but I want you to hear it and understand
okay,
it.
Okay, all right.
That's one of my problems with it. It's anti-intellectual, right? So, and the way this plays out in the real world in politics, because this is what people in the political world do all the time, right? They make truth claims. So, a big one is murder is wrong, right? That's a truth claim that's made all the time. And if you were to ask the average person, not the average philosopher necessarily, but the average person, is murder is bad is just objectively true? They're, of course, they're going to say, yes, it is. And you're going to say, so where does that come from? I mean, what determined that that's true? And they would say either God did, right? Or they would say it's just a natural truth, right? It comes from nature. It's naturally true that murder is bad. Well, then there's nothing to talk about anymore. Here's how it plays out in really, really pernicious ways that are fundamentally anti-libertarian, by the way. After 9/11, you may not remember this, you may not have noticed it at the time, but there was this concerted effort by not just ordinary American jingoists, but by very, very sophisticated American and European social scientists and academics and philosophers and historians to resurrect the category of, and they said this, evil, right? To place people like Osama bin Laden within the category of evil, which meant taking them outside the realm of analysis, right? Of inquiry, of discourse. So, and of course, what they were trying to do was take a shortcut to obliterating as many Muslims as they could. Because if we place those people in the category of evil, then there's no discussing what the cause of this thing they did was. There's no chance of certainly negotiating with these people. You can't negotiate with Satan. There's no reason to do anything but get in your F-16 fighter planes and bomb the shit out of them, right?
Yeah, attack their expense.
But I mean,
okay. So I'm trying. Yeah, this is my first objection. My first problem with objective claims like this, with naturalist claims like that, right? So to me, it's metaphysical, right? As with the way that many people think about Al Qaeda, right, and ISIS now, as being evil, in Satan, right? That's actually a metaphysical claim, right? Mm-hmm. It's saying that they are something apart from human existence, human inquiry, analysis, all of that, right? Yeah. It's just this thing outside of human consciousness that must be dealt with.
Well, no, they're making a statement in regards to ethics, though, right? These people do this, therefore they are
actually,
evil.
Actually, I think it's outside of even ethics, right?
Well, because it's their outside view of everything. Ethics, their view of ethics, right? Which I think are bullshit, right? I don't even.
Yeah, yeah.
It's I use the word evil on occasion, right? Because part of a job that I used to do, I would interview child molesters, right? And I dealt with people who fucked kids, right? Mm-hmm. And so my guttural reaction is, this is an evil piece of shit, and it'd be great if a bullet went through his fucking head, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a guttural reaction. That doesn't mean, therefore, this person is evil. There's some kind of superstitious thing in regards to it. Most likely, he was also abused as a child. There's a lot of other things to try to understand, right?
But you were right. It is an ethical claim. Yes, it is an ethical claim. That's the fourth branch, and we'll get to that. But to me, it's the same problem, right? Once you make an ethical claim or a moral claim about something, it's good or bad, then again, we're done with the conversation, right? Nothing should be said about someone who fucks a child, or there should be nothing said about someone who flies airplanes into buildings or beheads journalists, right? What? This is the Sean Hannity way of thinking, but unfortunately infects most of us, actually, right? What are we doing talking about what caused that? What caused that person to do that? What's the context of their lives, the context of this thing, the politics of a book? Shut up and kill them, right? So that's that actually all stems from this idea that there are certain things in the world that are outside of subjective reality. It's just an objective fact. It is just a natural fact that Osama bin Laden is Satan and child molesters are evil and they should all just be done. The only question is, how do we actually kill them? Do we just burn them to death or bury them underground or topple stone walls?
It's like there's no room for debate about anything that's prior to that. It's just a definitive conclusion. Now what do we do, basically? Right. How do we expend the effort? But
Can I offer a point of clarity real quick before we go too far?
Yes, please do, because my head is filling up with what I feel like are points of clarity, and maybe...
Well,
go ahead.
Okay, so we're using a lot of claims here in regards to understanding other people and things like that, and when it comes to the topic of ethics, at least if you ever look up Murray Rothbard, Hans Hermann Hoppe, a lot of the good Austrian types of folks, they separate the claims in regards of morality and ethics as two succinctly different things. Ethics are a matter of property disputes, i.e., we live in a world where we're going to have to deal with rivalrous goods because we live in a world of scarcity, right? So therefore, trying to find universally consistent norms that are not contradicted by the very act of living, right, are a good way by which to be able to live life, right? And something like property rights, right? Like by the very act of us living, we are assuming that at least a form of property rights exists. Because in order to be able to live, we have to take up space.
So that's a pragmatic claim, right?
Yeah.
That's saying that's all that is. That's,
exactly.
And I have no issue with that whatsoever.
You don't have an issue with that.
Right?
Okay.
You understand the difference. It's a pragmatic claim. If Rothbard and some people, Anthony Gregory just 20 minutes ago told me that Rothbard did make universalist claims, natural. So I don't know. But anyway, there's a difference between saying, we should live according to these particular rules because we'll live better. That's fine, right? And saying we should live according to these rules because they're written in nature.
Can I make a point of clarification in regards to the universalist claim of Rothbard?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Anthony Gregory is right about kind of early Rothbard stuff because originally a lot of his NAP stuff was based off of natural rights theory, which is mostly a lot of it's garbage. It's still this kind of God thing in regards to it.
Exactly.
It was Hans Hermann Hoppe's what was known as argumentation ethics that kind of separated that, which was exactly the points I've already brought up regarding, you know, just trying to find logically consistent norms that are a result of us just kind of living. And if we're going to have any kinds of norms, we shouldn't have it set up in a specific way to where it doesn't apply to other human beings. It should apply to all kind of a thing. But that's a separate thing. I just wanted to make a point of clarification because I think if it's important, if we're just going to be throwing around words like, well, because truth claims, therefore Osama bin Laden's evil, and somehow they're synonymous.
Right. And see, that was one of the things that I wanted to go back to, because I think that, you know, that connection when this philosophy that's built on the idea that there is an objective reality outside of us being called anti-intellectual, one of the appeals of objectivism to me, and I mean, I dabbled in philosophy before that, it was like so much of it seemed like it was just up in this cloud. And there was like a trap door or like an escape hatch out of everything. And this was clear. It made sense. Rand, who I do not quote frequently, but, you know, she called it a philosophy for living on Earth. So when I was talking to a nihilist recently, I said, well, it's nice that you have this philosophy, but what do you apply to your actual life? Right. Do you apply that there's these objective rules to actual living? Do you behave that way? Or do you behave like a nihilist? And he said, no, I guess I behave in the real world, you know, like an objectivist. And part of the appeal for me was it was entirely about induction and deduction and cause and effect. And to compare that to somebody like Sean Hannity saying Osama bin Laden is evil, no questions asked, I would think the objectivist process, the epistemology, would be entirely to unpack that, to know everything you could about the cause and effect of that. So I don't see, like, Sean Hannity and objectivism, like, in the same conversation to me,
it's like, poisoning the well.
I think it is.
Well, and actually, the big O objectivists, the orthodoxy, the Ayn Rand Institute folks.
Oh, they would,
even,
yeah.
And
yeah.
Even David Kelly. I mean, I wrote an article for Strike the Root about this because I called it objectivist goose stepping.
Yeah.
Because they were not peeling back the layers and figuring out what actually happened historically that led to this situation.
Leonard Peikoff is a fucking fascist mongrel.
Peikoff, they are the biggest warmongers, basically.
He's a terrible human being.
He's told Bill O'Reilly had to calm him down one day on Fox News when he was, it was like at the buildup to the invasion
O'Reilly
of Iraq.
O'Reilly look like a moderate, basically.
O'Reilly was like, calm down, mm-hmm. Leonard. My goodness, bomb the Middle East to glass.
And so what is the big issue here is context dropping, right? What is the context, the historical context, right? The developmental context in these individuals that led to this particular thing. And that is really not something that these folks really like to do because it requires a little bit of introspection, and a little bit of analysis that doesn't sound so definitive, So I don't think they like to convey this notion that I don't know, I need to investigate this. I need more facts. I need more evidence to marshal a case for this or that.
Right.
So dropping the context is a real common thing that people do when they're in that morally righteous sort of state.
Let's not forget.
So go ahead, my point about Hannity, was not that he's exactly the same as objectivists. My point was that he makes objective truth claims the way that objectivists do, right?
Yeah.
And my more important point is that that tends to have pretty bad consequences. First of all, it is by definition anti-intellectual, guys. You understand that, right? If you make a claim that's rooted in truth, rooted in nature or God, there's no conversation to be had about it, right?
Well, okay, so let's get back to that question about are we on Skype right now? Because facts are very important, are they not? Because when you're driving your car and you're getting all the sensory input, there's perceptual input, you are making decisions, and mostly it's automatized at that point.
Right.
Your unconscious is handling a lot of it. But if you move your arm to the right or left, you could crash into something and kill yourself. So those are...
Yeah.
That's showing that you're getting feedback from reality, and there's facts that need to be taken into account in order to actually navigate and to live well.
Within the map we have drawn around the world. That's what I'm saying. So what we do is we get the points of light, the sensory perceptions, right? And we draw a map around it, right? We draw patterns around it. And then many of us, not all of us, but many of us agree on particular drawings, a particular map, right? So that's called a culture. And then we all basically live inside of that. We do live inside of that culture. We agree to live inside of that culture. So the four of us agree, for the purposes of this project, that what we are doing is talking via Skype.
And if one of us didn't agree to that, then what would happen?
We'd be living in a different culture. So imagine, right, if we...
But it wouldn't erase the fact.
But if you handed this computer and this internet line and with the Skype software on it to a villager in the rainforest of Indonesia, they would have a very different idea about what's happening here.
That's not the claim. Like, okay, because that's a matter of beliefs rather than, okay, so I can choose to believe that if I just think hard enough, I'll float into the sky. But I'm not going to, no matter how hard I decide to believe that.
No, you are actually. So what I
is it a psychedelic?
I ask. Of course, my students always say, "Well, does that mean you can walk through that wall?" And I say, "Yeah, it does actually." And they say, "Well," I say, "Yeah, you know how? Ask a prisoner. Ask someone who's in San Quentin whether they walk through walls. They do every single day."
What the fuck does that mean?
I want to see a demonstration. Seriously.
That in the nicest way possible. I'm just legitimately confused.
Because their mind is outside the wall. Of course, right?
Okay, that's what you within do when you read their consciousness, though. That's actual walls they're walking through.
Your mind goes somewhere else when you read a book.
For sure. Yeah, that's the brilliance of the conceptual faculty. We're able to take ourselves out into the other galaxies, even, and science fiction and so forth.
So what you can do is you can say that my mind being outside wherever, outside that wall, floating in through the air, that's not real, or that's less real than whatever you want to claim reality is. And I want to say that it's just as real as any other reality.
I would say it is in reality. It's a facet of consciousness that's happening. But is it objective? Yeah. I mean, there is a distinction between objectivity and subjectivity. If you're saying everything is subjective, that makes no sense because subjective is something in relation to what's objective.
Can we say in the two situations that are being described, it's a tie for the consciousnesses, right? As far as how real the consciousnesses are. But the reality of what they're experiencing, that's not a tie. Right. Somebody traveling to a different universe and somebody labeling things in their immediate environment. Both of those consciousnesses are just as real, but the experiences of the of each consciousness are not equally real.
So one is having mental events and one is having actual events along with the mental events. You know, that's the thing.
Right.
What does actual mean?
When you walk through a wall, literally. Right. Versus.
What does literally mean in your mind?
Well,
yeah, no. So, if Brett were to get up and walk through that wall,
see, we have to acknowledge facts, which is a wall.
Do you see the wall behind me?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Care to demonstrate?
So, well, just take my word for it. The wall right next to me is. You hear that sound?
Okay.
So you get a. It's like plasterboard. You know, it's a house with wood studs underneath. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You know the wall, right?
Yeah.
So is that hard or soft?
From our purposes, on a practical level, it's hard.
From 0 to 10, how hard is it?
Compared to what?
I'm really excited
diamond?
To see if that
diamond
is
would exactly, be the hardest,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, compared to what?
Yeah.
Exactly, right?
So yeah, concepts are relational.
A relativist.
Well, concepts are relational, that's the thing.
Relative to what?
Relative to other concepts, other things in reality, other identifications that we've made. Every concept is a mental integration of units according to their distinguishing characteristics. You know, what distinguishes one set of units from another set of units, and we
all
unite
which,
these by
all
specific
of which are
definitions.
Right? How big is it? Is it large or small?
So you're getting into the variability that can happen within particular units, right? Because
exactly.
This table is a table, and so is a tiny table, right? They're both tables. It's a concept, but what's the distinguishing characteristic thing to put things on, right?
Okay. So, right, all of which was invented by us, right? Units,
well, the language
inches and feet and yards were invented by human beings, right?
Yep, rules of measurement, for sure.
Yep, which we imposed on the world, on sensory perceptions,
and it's
right?
Arbitrary whether to use a foot or a meter. I mean, that's an arbitrary system of measurement that's based
exactly.
on historical reasons, obviously. But
exactly.
we need to
you
define
sound like a relativist, Wes.
Well, no. There's a big difference here because I'm using objectivity to understand things in a non-contradictory way. So, again, a human being cannot walk through a wall, especially like a cinder block wall, right?
Yes, they can. We just established that.
Unless,
they do every day.
You know, all other things being equal. So maybe if they're fired through a cannon, but that's not really walking.
No,
right?
I thought you agreed with me that my mind can go through that wall.
It's not
in
actually
mind,
going through the wall. So
in
look,
your mind, you can.
Here, look. So past that
I can
door,
bring my body with me
Thaddeus,
in my mind.
Thaddeus, hold
that's
on.
That's what we do. Okay, sure.
Are you sitting on your magic pillow?
Thaddeus,
I'm telling you right now,
quick.
I am flying through that wall.
So behind this wall right
just
now,
be the wall.
I can think in my mind right now that I know it's right behind there. But if I physically move my body to go back there, it may be a different thing than what I thought it was in my head. This
would be a nonsensical discussion for construction workers.
Yes,
seriously.
Right,
for
course, because
builders.
They're operating very, very much in that particular structure, that format, that,
but they're
that
not
map,
arbitrary
that
constructs
that we imposed on the world.
No,
course,
it's not
right?
a map, really. It's understanding reality, the thing that exists that you're living and breathing in. No, it isn't. How could it be begging the question? I'm curious.
Okay, so let's talk about the history of science then.
Okay.
Right? Don't we need to do that?
Sure. And by the way, science is taking a stance metaphysically of skepticism, not certainty. So they don't say there's a law of identity and causality and non-contradiction.
Oh my God, no.
They
Come
say
on,
that
no.
all knowledge is provisional, you see.
A few scientists do. You know very well that most scientists are very invested in truth.
Well, I remember Richard Dawkins in, I think it was a Blind Watchmaker, he said that it is possible for a statue to wave its hand, given, I think it was Dawkins that said that, but basically, it's not probable because of the nature of how long it would take for those atoms to do that in unison. But according to quantum physics, it's possible. So everything's possible in the realm of science.
So here's here's the foundational text for my people. you guys are aware of Thomas Kuhn,
mm-hmm.
Structures of Scientific Revolutions.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. So written in the early 1960s, Thomas Kuhn, K-U-H-N, very, very, very important book in my world, in which he, it's just a history book. It's a history of science, in which he just goes back to, he goes back to the Copernican Revolution, and he shows that, you know, during one epoch, everyone believed that, you know, the sun revolved around the earth, and that was truth. And there was no question about that, and if you disagreed with that, you were burned at the stake. There was no conversation to be had. Everyone believed that to be the absolute truth.
So, but that would be dogmatism, right?
Right. And then Copernicus comes along and he says, no, actually, it's just the other way around, right? Mm-hmm. Earth goes around the sun. Mm-hmm. And now everyone thinks that's true. And then he went through again and again and again, one scientific revolution after another, after another, after another. And of course, the Copernican paradigm was overturned. It wasn't the way that Copernicus explained the world or described the universe. It's not the way we think about it now. It's sort of similar, but it's quite different. The theory of gravity. You guys know about it's called the revised theory of gravity. There's now a massive, violent debate among physicists about the theory of gravity and theory of relativity.
Okay, that was really heavy.
That was taken for granted. Really, you know, heavy. That was the absolute truth. There's no question about it. And now they're having major discussions about this, and they found things in outer space they've seen through telescopes that are moving in the ways that don't follow the law of gravity. There's a massive debate among physicists, not among just weird relativist philosophers.
They are debating how objective things work. Though
the interpretations of reality, basically,
yeah, right.
So there's the Newtonian.
There's
way
no,
of describing
there's no
it.
Need
so,
for the
so
interpretation.
This term. So here's the thing. So if even scientists constantly revise their ideas about what is objective reality, then how on earth can you make a claim that there is one?
Objective reality, right? So you use that phrase in that question. Right. So what are they dedicating their minds to? What are they trying to figure out? Right. They're trying to figure out how stuff works in reality. By definition, you can't escape the nature of reality. You're always in it. Only non-existence will take you out of it. Obviously losing your consciousness, which is, okay, you know, the result of brain processes.
So forgive me, but I believe you're indulging in tautology. Right. So you're saying there is objective reality. Therefore, there is objective reality.
Well,
and what I'm telling you is that human beings have changed their minds constantly, forever, about what objective reality is.
That's because they're indulging in context dropping and contradictions.
There's never been a static objective reality, never in human history, all of human history. Now maybe there could be tomorrow.
Wait, I would modify that by saying there may have never been a static interpretation of objective reality.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
That's the big deal.
That's subjective, right? We're talking about outside of interpretation, outside of subjectivity.
So you guys keep saying
he's making a truth claim about reality, is he not?
Say that again, Thad.
So you guys keep saying that there is something outside of interpretation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm asking you, I'm telling you that I've never seen any evidence for it. Like, I've never seen any evidence of God. He may exist, but I've never seen any evidence for it. I've never seen any evidence of static, eternal, universal reality.
What's your definition of evidence?
Right. Well, I mean, that changes too, but even within your logical system.
Yeah, but when you say I've never seen any evidence for it, so what is your definition of evidence that would be required to determine this? If... Suppose hypothetically that you did encounter such evidence, what would it have to be? And what's the definition of that?
I'm saying that even within the established logical structures or regimes, they're called, right? Even within those logical structures, it changes all the time. So even there, I've never seen it.
That's where predominantly stays, because their philosophies
are flawed.
Where it stays
the same for centuries or millennia or even for a year.
Yeah,
it's frustrating
and disorienting to see scientists change views so dramatically like that. You know, one epoch they're claiming things definitively this way, and the next one it's different, right?
Exactly, right.
So yeah, so that is an example of humans that are not making. They're trying to claim certainty where there really can't be at that point in time. They haven't gathered enough evidence to declare with certainty whether things are what they are. What they're trying to look at.
So do you believe we ever will be able to?
Well, we just did in this conversation, right? We're all using Skype. There are facts that we rely on every single day, like Brett said about the nihilist.
I didn't agree with that. I didn't say it's an objective truth. I said that I'm agreeing to operate within this particular structure.
And you're making an objective claim about this.
He's stating that he, on a practical level, he's going by these assumptions that seem to be proven through our observations. But that doesn't mean that it is a perfect understanding of what's actually there, right? So I think a good argument that can be made in relation to what he's stating is, for instance, our eyeballs don't actually reflect what is actually going on around us right now, right? There's all these different layers of lighting that we're not able to see, correct? Mm. And the image that we're seeing right now isn't even what our eyeball is seeing. It's actually flipped back in our brain because our eyeballs are kind of retarded.
And it's a simplification.
And what are you relying on to make those determinations?
And I understand. We're trying to find those standards. But I think the major statement, though, is whether or not we are sure or certain of any of those things. Right?
But there
are standards that we go off of in order to be able to understand things. But that doesn't mean... therefore, whatever we believe in that particular case using those standards is true.
So the question is, have you vetted for contradictions, right?
And that's what we're trying, and that's what human beings are constantly trying to do.
But he's taking issue with the idea that you can actually determine the nature of reality. You can determine facts. You can make objective claims without contradiction. He's taking issue with that framework, right?
Again, it's about existing outside of human consciousness. That's it. That's all. Does something exist outside of human consciousness? That's it. That's what it boils down to.
Yeah, it's an issue of solipsism, correct?
Well,
ish, right?
Sort, yeah. How do I know? It's been 30 years since I read Russell, but yeah. I think George Russell came up with that shit. But anyway, I think so.
It's primacy of consciousness versus primacy of reality. That's the difference.
Yeah, the thing is, there's another version of what could be a possible an argument, right? Which is the solipsism, right? Which is essentially, I'm not sure if anything exists outside of my mind, so I can't assume that it does exist.
Yes.
That's also a non-argument, though, in that particular case.
It's inherently contradictory.
I don't know if it's inherently contradictory, actually.
Wait, what are you relying on to determine that you actually have a consciousness?
My own brain. Right.
How could you decipher that you have a consciousness if it's not distinct from something else? Like if all you know is consciousness, how could you call it consciousness?
So can I make a suggestion?
See, this is all stolen concept fallacy stuff right to the core. It's relying on concepts in an attempt to dispute.
Brett?
Yeah. Go ahead.
There's nothing wrong with this. We're
going around
about our listeners.
Yeah,
I think I think if we move to ethics and politics, a lot of this will be more clear, and I think the importance of it will be more clear. I think what happened. I think the average listener right now is wondering what the fuck does this matter, right?
Yeah,
and I think it matters a whole lot.
It does matter a whole lot. Absolutely.
I want to get, and this is all of our fault. I think most people listening to this. In fact, I had a student yesterday who just said, "I don't care. What does it matter?" And I think it matters a lot. I mean, life and death a lot.
That's what we can definitely agree.
Let's get to ethics.
Right, okay. And just in closing, before we go on to question two at the 1 hour mark here, I just want to say that was the appeal of objectivism. Like, oh, there is a fucking point to being alive, right?
Your mind is competent to think, right?
Exactly. Snakes are the worst creatures. First up today, we have Herbert H., who joined the AV Club on March 24th, 2014, and he is in Hooksett, New Hampshire. Well, you know, I live in North Manchester, and I can see Hooksett when I look out my window, you know. Sarah Palin, remember? Anyway, there's not much I can tell you about Hooksett. It was incorporated in 1822,
I've spent a lot of time there, and if you're ever passing through the area, I would recommend USA Subs for lunch or dinner. Before I ate a low-carb diet, I used to go to USA Subs, and I would get a foot-long seafood and crab sandwich. Now, the actual crab content of the seafood and crab at USA Subs is debatable, but this thing is delicious, and they have lots of Utz brand potato chips that you can buy to go with it. So thanks, Herbert. I hope you're getting over to USA Subs once in a while for that delicious seafood and crab. I get all the veggies, but no cheese. I'm not a maniac. Next up, we have Jessica R., who is in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. Do you like the Civil War? Because big part of Civil War history happened in Harpers Ferry, John Brown's famous raid. So this was an attempt by an abolitionist named John Brown in 1859 to start an armed slave revolt. And they were going to get the arms by seizing an arsenal that was in Harpers Ferry. Now, of course, the raid was unsuccessful. Brown and his 20 men were defeated by Robert E. Lee, a colonel at the time. Robert E. Lee, of course, later went on to develop a line of delicious dessert products using the slogan, "Nobody doesn't like Robert E. Lee," I think. We continue on to Kate M. of Leadbelly Enterprises. Whenever somebody signs up using the name of a business, I like to give them a little plug. So Kate lives in Chester Springs, Pennsylvania. Now, Chester Springs, just a tiny little town, so we're going to do Chester County for trivia's sake. And this was the site of the first railroad in Pennsylvania, which became the Pennsylvania Railroad, as well as the Reading Railroad of Monopoly fame. By the way, I was born in Reading, Pennsylvania. That railroad also began in Chester County and went up to Reading, and then west to Lancaster County. And we did some Civil War trivia before. Let's go back to the Revolutionary War. Both the Battle of Brandywine and the Battle of Valley Forge were fought on the edges of Chester County, Pennsylvania. So thanks, Kate. Moving right along to Rick M., who is in Auckland, New Zealand, a very beautiful place. There are about 50 volcanoes around Auckland. And here's an interesting one. Rangitoto, the volcano visible out in the harbor, is believed to be only 600 or 700 years old. And this means that some of the Maori settlers actually could have viewed its birth. One more quick thing about New Zealand, which is very important to me. If you're trying to decide on a vacation and it comes down to Australia or New Zealand, pick New Zealand. Why? There's no snakes there. No snakes, native or introduced, in all of New Zealand. That's a beautiful thing. Snakes are the worst creatures. And finally, John K. from Reno, Nevada, signed up with the name Coffee Time Comics. Reno, Nevada, known as the biggest little city in the world. Here's an interesting thing. About 450 miles southeast of Reno, we have Las Vegas, which is known as the marriage capital of the world. But interestingly, Reno became the divorce capital of the world. From about 1929 to 1939, the Washoe County Courthouse approved 30,000 couples for divorce, many of whom were married in Las Vegas. So there you go. That's Nevada. Come for the marriage, stay for the divorce. And the hookers. You know, a good, clean, well-vetted hooker can really be helpful after a tough divorce.
New subscriber, geography, trivia. You just say a person's name and then tell a fact about where they live.